call this meeting of the Senate Finance, Health, and Social Services Budget Subcommittee. And today, chairing it in the absence of Senator Olson is John Coghill. And I'm joined here with Senator Gardner. Senator McGuire is in another meeting and will be here as soon as she can get here. So, but I wanted to go ahead and give you full opportunity to bring before us issues concerning the Mental Health Trust. And so that's the issue on the budget question today, and any recommendations that we can give to the full Finance Committee from you. So state your name, and I think what we'll do, Mr. Jesse, is we'll just ask questions along the way.
Right.
As it always is, you'll probably say the answer is on the next sheet, but we'll try to stay up with you. Thank you. Mr. Jesse, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Senator, member of the subcommittee. For the record, my name is Jeff Jesse. I'm the Chief Executive Officer of the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority. And I'm going to be working off of the slide presentation that you should have in front of you. So we'll start on the first page, and I'm going to go quickly through some of this background material because I think both of you are pretty familiar with the trust. The second slide on the first page shows the trust beneficiaries. These are people with mental illness, developmental disabilities, chronic alcoholism, Alzheimer's disease and related dementia, and traumatic brain injury. Going to the second page, as you know, we at the trust don't do anything really on our own. We have a lot of partners, and process are us. And so as you look through, you can see not only the Advisory Board on Alcoholism Drug Abuse and the Mental Health Board, but also the Governor's Council on Disabilities, the Commission on Aging. We have three commissioners that serve as advisors to the trustees, the Brain Injury Network, and the Suicide Prevention Council. So we work pretty closely with all these organizations, including, of course, the executive branch agencies. So on the bottom of that page, you can see the funding that the trustees have available for FY14. And that comes from four principal sources. One is, of course, the payout. To refresh your memory, we work on an endowment model, just like a private foundation. Our endowment is now somewhere in the neighborhood of $450 million. Yes, sir.
Mr. Jesse, evidently one of the slides is missing. So what slide number are you?
I think
next page. We're on. Okay, I just... What slide
I'm
number?
On page 2, which has slides 3 and 4 on it.
Gotcha. And I have that page missing in mine. So
I do too, actually.
Uh-oh.
Yeah. Do I have it electronically?
Oh, what we did, Mr. Jesse, and maybe we should look. We take just an at ease for a second. All right, just a little technical problem. What happened was the slides got copied only on one side and they were printed on two sides. So while we're printing those, Senator Gardner has a question for you, Jeff.
Thank you. This morning I was visited by some people who are working with the Statewide Independent Living Council, and they worked, I believe, under contract with Manelik. And they had heard about cuts to a behavioral health grant that they said provided the grants under which all of their substance abuse counselors were funded. And so we spent some time trying to track that down, and I'm not really very good at reading budget documents, but I couldn't figure out what they're talking about. Are you familiar with that? Should they be concerned?
Yeah, Senator Gardner, through the chair, yeah, we heard the same rumor, and I tried to track that down. And what we believe happened is that last year, Senator Ellis, got a $9 million alcohol tax increment placed in the budget as a one-time increment to be spent over 3 years. And so what we think happened is that $9 million showed up in the FY13 budget, but because it was an OTI, it isn't showing up in the FY14 budget. So it looks like the grant line is $9 million less.
So that's internal language, OTI, for those listening.
One-time increment.
Thank you.
So we don't think that the governor proposed a reduction in alcohol grants. It's just that the budget showed that one-time increment of $9 million in the 13 budget. And so when it wasn't in the 14 budget, which it was never intended to be, it appeared like it was a $9 million decrement.
Okay, so it's in a drawer somewhere.
Well, the department has the money.
Yeah, okay. Well, I'll be happy to call and tell them that if they haven't already heard it.
So while we're having the conversation about budget questions, one of the questions I have is when a new issue is brought forward and I have it written down here. So we have an increment added in that goes into the base from, let's see, I'm gonna read this because I have to get it right in my brain. You have projects funded from year to year, and the funding is removed from the adjusted base, but we have an increment from your budget. What I understand is sometimes the positions don't follow. Or they get left out of the calculation. And I very inartfully gave that to you, but just be thinking about that as we go into the flow of dollars from your budget to the state budget. And when it's in an increment in your budget, how that affects the state budget. And so just following positions has become difficult, I think. And I'm only bringing it up as a point that was brought up to me. And since I didn't think of the question, I probably don't, I'm not understanding everything I'm asking at this point. But
well, Senator, I think I kind of understand what you're aiming at. And in fact, we've had a number of conversations with Ledge Finance. In fact, I think Amanda's in the back of the room. And we're working on a way to provide better information in the budget, you know, so that you can see what it is that we're trying to do. As you know, we zero-base budget. So every year we basically start over from a zero-base budget. And
novel
that's
idea.
Gotten confusing. If I understand where you're going, I think that, yes, we understand that that's an issue, and I think we're going to be able to work out a system that's going to be a little more transparent.
All right. So, and then for my question, one of the things that I hear a lot, especially with some of the things that you get to do on startup projects, we've done many pilot projects, some of the bigger ones that you're going to describe even in your presentation today, like No Child Left Behind. But it caused a question in my mind, how many pilot projects have we rolled out, now are still pilot, and how many are handed off into full-time budget issues, and how many are just dropped because they prove out that, you know, pilot projects aren't going to work. Mm-hmm. You don't have to answer that question right now, but it's a question I'll have probably before we close out this committee that I'll be looking for. What's hanging out there? Because I know that in your, I looked just in flipping through the page today, I know a couple of them are mentioned, but I don't know that all of them are.
So what you're looking for, Senator, if I can clarify, you want to know If the trust has started up something, and we have an expectation that if it proves up, that eventually you would include it in the general fund budget, then you want to know how many of those are there, how much of a potential liability, if you will, are you likely to be facing downstream? Is that?
Sure. The two questions I'll have continually in my mind is that first one, what's my potential for liability? And then what's the evidence base of those? Because if they are still in the proving stage, you know, I'm kind of interested. If we've already taken them on, did we stay true to the program?
So you also want to look back at where we've done this in the past. For example, just to throw one out, mental health courts.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So you'd like us to go back and say, okay, we started these mental health courts with trust money. We transition them to general fund. Are they still working? Are we still getting results from them? Are they doing what we thought they were going to do when you took on the funding of them? Am I catching
one good example, because we still are doing them almost as pilots in many ways, because they haven't found themselves into statewide popularity, although they're growing.
Right.
But it's a question that continually comes to mind as we start new pilots. I want to make sure historically we're following either a good system or we have a good way of looking back and saying, okay, it worked there, but we've morphed enough to where it's not working according to the original intent.
Yeah, it'd be Senator, just an interesting. I might add, too, that last year the House added intent language into the mental health bill that for any new project that the trust was bringing forward with MTAR that we anticipated was a new project that might end up being on the state responsibility, the original request from Representative Gruenberg was we simply tell you how long the trust intended to fund it, mm-hmm. and if at some point we would ask for it to be, if it proved up, we would ask for it to be transitioned into the general fund. I actually added language to that legislative intent to require us to also provide you with what performance measures we were going to use in order to establish whether or not this was going to be a successful project. We intend to honor that legislative intent, frankly, whether it's put in every year or not, because it makes sense. You know, we have been working with the legislature long enough to know that, you know, you're not going to do well here playing gotcha. You know, you can surprise you or something one time, and then that's it. So we want you to know up front. Because frankly, if it's something that you don't see a policy reason why we should be doing it at all, then you have the option to not authorize the trust funding to even start the thing.
And because many of the things are brought out from a thoroughly searched out programmatic approach that you've brought forward, it would be interesting, you know, to kind of look over our shoulder a little bit and say, okay, we started those. Mm-hmm. Did they get better, or did we lose the integrity of that look? And I think the courts have gone and done well. Mm-hmm. So certainly I think that's a model that has worked.
Well, and Senator, when we get to bring the kids home, I'll talk a little bit about that, because one of the things we're worried about is this is bring the kids home is the second time we've solved that problem. The first time was the Alaska Youth Initiative. And because we didn't put any tripwires or ongoing surveillance of how that program worked, it did get out of whack. The legislature was forced to defund it. We didn't put anything in its place, and that started another round of exodus to out-of-state placements that ended up resulting in Bring the Kids Home. So, in fact, yesterday at the Bring the Kids Home meeting, a lot of the discussion in the work group was how do we identify tripwires or data elements so that as we leave that initiative, we know if it starts to go south again.
And that's one of the things I'm interested in. So it doesn't sound like my thinking is out of line. No. We did now get your completed presentation. So why don't you go ahead and start back on page three and just start from there, because that's where we left off from my perspective.
Okay. Then we're looking at the trust funding. I've already gone over the trust advisory boards and partners. If you look at the trust funding, you can see our payout, the 4.25% of our principal, is just over $18 million. That's based on a four-year rolling average. The prior year's lapse of a little over $3.5 million. Land office income of just over $3 million. And then interest on what we call our checking account, which is the account at revenue, where the income that the trust is preparing to spend is kept and earns some interest every year, for a total of about $25 million in available funds, out of which, just to refresh your memory, we pay for the admin costs of the trust authority, which you approve, the trust land office, which we contract with DNR for, and then the rest of the trust funding is distributed in two ways. One is through the legislature, as you authorize agencies to receive and spend trust money, MTAR, and then directly from the trust to grantees through authority grants. And the way we distinguish which money should come through the state and which should go directly to a grantee has a couple of factors. One is we don't want to create a parallel mental health system. We're supposed to be creating a comprehensive, integrated mental health system. So we don't want to be putting grants out that confuse the landscape. We already have the tribal system, we have the VA, you know, military system, and the state system. We don't want to create a parallel system. However, if there's it's more efficient for us to directly grant the money, or if it's a project that no state agency has an interest in administering, or if we feel a need to keep a tighter rein on how the project evolves than we think a state agency will, then we'll do a direct grant. But we try to get most of our funding to flow through state government for not only the integrated purpose, so that you see what we're doing with the money and how it's contributing to the service. On page three at the top, you have the five focus areas that the trust has identified. Bring the kids home, disability justice, housing, workforce development, and beneficiary projects. Now, only one of those, really, bring the kids home, is primarily, almost exclusively, within the purview of the health and social services budget. But I'm going to talk about these other focus areas as well, because most of them have impacts to health and social services, either because health and social services is a full partner in the effort, or because health and social services is critical to the success of those focus areas, even if budgetarily they aren't a big player in that particular arena. And then below, you'll see the alcohol initiatives. I want to talk briefly about that. The Rasmussen Foundation, about 3 years ago, convened a group of stakeholders and others in Talkeetna for 2 days, because they were fed up with funding projects to deal with the consequences of alcohol problems, and no one was going upstream to figure out how to prevent the problem in the first place. We had judges, commissioners, providers, family members, tribal representatives, military representatives, and we spent the last couple of years trying to figure out how to put that initiative together. And we're at the point where this is going to go to light speed. And so I think it's very important that we talk about it some. What we've done to staff the initiative now is there is a half-time program officer at the trust, Mara Rabinowitz. Some of you may know Mara. Mm-hmm. And then at the Rasmussen Foundation, Alicia Towns-Bain is also half-time, and they are the Recover Alaska staff team. And so essentially they are one full-time equivalent working every day on how to advance the Recover Alaska agenda. The funders are the Rasmussen Foundation, which has already allocated $500,000 for the next 2 years to get certain things started, and then the Trust and the Mat-Su Health Foundation are the prime funders. And of course, we intend to work very closely with the department and tribal partners as well. So you'll hear a lot more about this initiative as we go forward. And by the way, we don't enter this effort without considerable trepidation, because many have gone before and spent many millions of dollars trying to do something in this arena, and quite frankly, there isn't much to show for any of it. So we realize that this is a long-term issue. The trustees have not yet made this a focus area. But it is certainly, as Bring the Kids Home wraps up, it's one of the leading contenders to become a trust focus area. The second part of that is the Title IV review. This actually came out of the successful effort last year on the part of the industry to convince you to move the Alcohol Beverage Control Board from the Department of Public Safety into the Department of Commerce and Economic Development. In the course of that debate and dialogue, many of the parties, even though we may have differed on that particular move, realized that Title IV, the state's alcohol beverage control framework, is dramatically out of date. It was fashioned almost 50 years ago. It's been amended in a hodgepodge way over many years. And so the Alcohol Beverage Control Board has gathered a group of stakeholders that have now split into committees to look at major parts of Title IV with the idea of coming forward and recommending some changes. And at this point, everyone's playing nicely in the sandbox. I certainly imagine that at some point there will be some differences of opinion around some of the proposed changes between the industry and some of the rest of us, but we're going to try to stay on the same page as long as we can.
Jeff, can you give us kind of a high-level view of what are the topics that it will fall into?
Sure. One would be internet sales. That's a growing issue. People now can order alcohol through the internet. That raises two problems. One is you want to make sure that underage kids can't buy alcohol and have it delivered through the internet or through the mail. And the second is you don't want the distributors to be able to avoid state taxation. So there's a committee looking at, okay, how can we, you know, fashion a statutory framework that will ensure that underage buyers can't get booze through the mail and that they can't avoid taxation. And this is an issue on which I think there will be an identity of interest between the industry and the advocates.
Sure, and there's that, and then you have dry and damp villages.
Yes, local option is another subcommittee, and they're looking at our current option, local option laws, and seeing if there are things that can be updated or otherwise modified. Another one is the license structure. We started with a population-based alcohol control framework, meaning that one way you try to control consumption is you try to control access. And that's done generally two ways. One is the states that are state-controlled, so you got to go to a state-run liquor store. The other is through a licensing system, which normally limits the number of licenses per population. So you can have one license for every 1,500 people. Well, what's happened over time is there have been many, many more licenses added to the structure that don't count towards the population base. We have catering licenses, and festival licenses, and theater licenses, duplicate licenses. My personal favorite is the remote military contractor license. If you're building a bridge to somewhere for the military remotely, you can get a license to provide your workers with alcohol. So the exceptions, if you will, have now eaten up the rule. And so there's a desire to look in that area. Another one is the role of the Alcohol Beverage Control Board. You know, what should they be doing, especially given their move and the policy implications of that? And I believe there's one other that I'm not going to remember.
Thank you. That gives me a good idea.
So moving on to page 4, slides 7 and 8, this is bring the kids home. So,
excuse me a second, Senator.
Before we turn this page, I have a quick question. Can you tell me the status of the longhouse in Spinard under the affordable appropriate housing?
Yes, I can talk about that. The longhouse is a hotel in Spinard, and we are in partnership with the Anchorage Community Mental Health Center to look at the feasibility of purchasing that building for the purpose of housing people with chronic mental illness that need supported housing. We are continuing to talk to the community councils. We have yet to do a housing project for our beneficiaries, frankly, that hasn't raised concerns in the community that we propose to place it in. The dilemma that we always face is that if we go to the community early, before everything has kind of been laid out, the concern we get is, well, you don't have all the answers. You know, I mean, we're asking you all these questions and you don't have all the answers. And so this thing doesn't sound like it's fully baked. If we wait until we have the answers to talk to the community, then the response is, well, this is a done deal. You didn't get any input from us. So I've just resigned myself that every one of these projects will go through a period I call the thrash, where we're listening to concerns and questions from the community, we're answering them as best we can, and as the project evolves, we get more and better answers to their questions, and in the end, in the past, we've generally been able to satisfy the majority of the community that this is going to be a well-run, positive contribution to the community. Some people will never be convinced, and then there's a group that wasn't convinced before it happened, but gets convinced once they see the actual results, and the Carlick Manor in Anchorage is a good example of that. So we are continuing to talk to the community. We're continuing to work out the mechanics of both the program side and the purchase and renovation of the facility side, and we'll see how that goes over the next several months.
That sounds like familiar landmarks to an election campaign.
Yeah, I can see a lot of parallels.
And yes, it is in my district.
It's a campaign for community support, and we appreciate that.
Well, yeah, and I might add too, I just have to give a shout out to Ernie Hall. Ernie is an assemblyman in Anchorage, and the community went to him and basically said, we want you to stop this. And Ernie was totally forthright from the beginning. He said, look, I got elected to represent everyone in my district, and these people need housing. And so we need, as a community, to start having a broader conversation about housing people with disabilities, and not have this NIMBY reaction every single time we try to do something.
Mr. Chair, if I might, and I don't know if you're aware, but Daryl Hess, I think, has done a really good job, too, because what he's basically said to the community council, and he works for the city, is that there is no standing for the council or anybody else
to derail this. He said, so your best bet is to think about what your real concerns are and take those to the meetings and try to address your real concerns.
Yep. And I think the majority of the community council members that we're working with are taking that to heart. And again, we're doing our best. But, you know, our philosophy on these projects is under-promise and over-deliver. Because the first time we tell a community that a project is going to work like this and it doesn't work, and they now have a problem, well, that's the end of the game from our standpoint. So we have a huge vested interest in making sure that the assurances we give the community are going to be met, because we have a long-term interest in housing our beneficiaries.
Thank you.
So, again, back to Bring the Kids Home. I'm not going to go through a lot of the genesis of this. I think, you know, I talked briefly about the demise of the Alaska Youth Initiative and how we ended up with over 400 kids out of state. The trust has the same basic approach to every one of our focus areas. What is the problem? Who are our partners that we need to engage, because we can't figure this out on our own? And then what is the strategic thinking that we need to apply, and how are we going to measure the results so that we know whether our strategies are effective or not effective? And we follow that with Bring the Kids Home. You can see on the bottom of page 4, slide 8, you can see the progress that we've made in keeping youth in Alaska. And I have to remind you, the Bring the Kids Home name was a little misnomer, in that really the goal was to keep kids in Alaska. You know, we weren't bringing tons of them back. Most of them were aging out as they returned. But you can see that the number of admissions has gone down dramatically. Another measure that we used wasn't just whether we were keeping these kids in state, but if they ended up in an RPTC, a residential psychiatric treatment center, when they were released, what was the frequency of them returning to that level of care? It doesn't do you a lot of good to put somebody through a program if when they leave the program, they decompensate and turn around and come right back in. Mm-hmm. And what we knew is that when we relied more heavily on out-of-state RPTC placement, we had a recidivism rate of around 20%. Now we've been able to drive that down to around 5%.
Is that, Jeff, is that because they're able to check into a local area for continual medication upgrades and changes?
Senator Coghill, that's exactly right. Two things. One is better communication before they return from the RPTC to the community, because what we used to get before is they'd go to Utah and no one would hear from them until on a Monday there'd be a phone call to the, say, Anchorage School District saying, Jeff's coming back on Wednesday. Good luck with that. Well, the community provider has no notice or ability to develop a program for the family. The school isn't ready for them. And so we did two things. One is we have a grant for folks to actually facilitate that communication between the RPTC and the local community, and bolster the community services, as Senator Coghill's pointing out, so that they will be more successful when they hopefully return home, because that's the, you know, the golden ring is getting them home.
Senator Gardner?
Slightly off that, but back to strategic thinking. Mm-hmm. The idea of intervening earlier, more intensively, and with the family, of course, makes sense. It's an ounce of prevention. What are we doing that's different from past years, and who's doing it?
Well, we're doing a couple things that's different. For example, we've developed a network of family peer supports. So you have families that have been through the drill before, being able to actually provide peer support to other families that are going through this for the first time, or maybe not the first time, but, you know, struggling through it themselves. That's tremendously valuable to families. And that was something that our system didn't have before. I mean, maybe if you knew somebody that had a kid in at RPTC, but now we've developed an actual network. And as I said, structuring the communication between the out-of-state facilities and the in-state programs and keeping the families engaged is something that didn't happen. So those are definitely new strategies that we added to the program.
So having these residential facilities in Alaska, has that helped us with a better understanding of the scope of need? I mean, the service delivery system that comes from social services, has that helped define it at all, or is
Absolutely, Senator. It's been tremendous that way. One of the things that we realized when we got into this a little ways is that, well, if we're going to catch these kids earlier, how do you identify them? You know, they don't spring from the head of Zeus. You know, there are early indications. Well, most of these families are not good self-reporters. And so we've convened an education committee to try to engage the school systems in working with us, not only on the return to school end, but at the front end, because they're the ones that are probably going to pick up on the fact that Jeff isn't doing so well and he's got some inappropriate behaviors. Maybe if we do something now, you know, we aren't going to have a problem with him when he's 13 or 14 or 15.
Right. And with the school issue we had back east, it just highlighted the need for that notice, that early notice, and then getting kind of not only for Alaska here how we can fill some of those needs, but then that communication level. So I think, you know, the early intervention part is pretty interesting and support and important. I just wanted to know if having these residential facilities and those moving out of the residential facilities, if now we have a better scope of service delivery. And of course, we're always interested in where are the blank spots. And I guess for me, when we look at our massive budget in the health and social service arena, especially in the behavioral health arena, where do we do our best collaboration? And that's, you know, something we're always going to have to be looking for. And the tighter dollars get, the more we're going to have to make that collaboration work. And so this Bring the Kids Home model actually forced a little bit of that kind of horizontal integration. And so lessons learned from that are going to be very important for us, I think.
Well, and I'll talk in a minute about our conversation with the full Senate Finance Committee last week and some of the unprecedented discussion about early prevention and intervention that happened at that meeting and
forward to it.
How that sort of comes through here. Looking at page 5, you can see that the funding for Bring the Kids Home was really a reinvestment of the out-of-state RPTC dollars. So you can see there, it's a little hard to see on this slide, but you can see the RPTC expenditures on the left. The solid bar, part of the bar at the bottom, is the out-of-state RPTCs, and you can see how that has gone down very dramatically over the course of the initiative. And the semi-transparent part of the bar, which is the in-state, has remained relatively stable, and that was by design. And remember, we didn't want to just build in-state residential RPTC beds. What we wanted to do was design services that match the needs of the kids. The kids were going to out-of-state RPTCs not because they always needed that level of care, but because there just wasn't anything else here. So you see in the middle, the community-based mental health Medicaid expenditures have gone up over the course of the initiative, as have the Bring the Kids Home General Fund grants, and that was by design. At the end of the day, I'm not going to tell you saved a lot of money, but you definitely avoided major costs for continuing the trend that we had. And frankly, we think you pretty much broke even, which for an initiative to get this kind of results, breaking even is a pretty substantial victory, at least in our opinion. At the bottom, you can start to see the results for beneficiaries around developing in-state treatment options for children with co-occurring and complex disorders. What happened during the course of this initiative is we got down to about 100, and it stalled. We couldn't seem to really get much below 100 kids out of state. There were still kids bubbling up that when they went to the utilization review process, none of our in-state providers could take them, and they ended up still going out of state.
That was a serious kind of the level problem, level five or whatever the needs are above?
Well, what it turned out to be is a systemic problem, because what we learned, and you can kind of see it from this chart, is that the last 100 kids, if you will, had very complex and co-occurring disabilities. So they weren't just severely emotionally disturbed, because those kids our mental health system knows how to do a pretty good job with. They also weren't just intellectually disabled, FAS or that, which our developmental disability system is pretty good at dealing with. A lot of the last 100 kids had both. And then you throw in autism and some of these others, and what we found is that, well, the mental health system won't take them because they're low intellectual functioning and their programs aren't really geared for people that can't have that level of thinking. And the developmental disability providers were saying, look, we can deal with that part, but this mental health stuff is outside of our range. We don't know what this psychosis stuff is. What are we supposed to do with that? So we've been looking at a couple of things. One is, okay, is there some irreducible number of complex kids for whom developing specialized programs in the state of Alaska is neither technologically nor financially feasible? You know, because they are just too complicated and intensive. And we think there is a number there. We don't know what it is, but there is a number. We have, however, recently, and the trust funded this, we've sent a number of folks from the Division of Behavioral Health, from the school district, from some providers, from North Star, back to a program in Maine that has taken some of these duly diagnosed individuals, particularly ones with pretty severe autism, and has been able to develop communication and behavior programs for those kids with an average length of stay of between 45 and 90 days. Right now, those kids are out of state with an average length of stay of over 400 days, and they aren't coming back any better than when they left. This program in Maine not only is very heavily weighted towards communication and behavior modification, but they bring the families and the community providers into the hospital while the child is in residence and have them shadow their programming and then actually take over the programming in the hospital so they learn how to do this. So that when the kid returns to the home or returns to the residential provider, they know what they're doing. And they send with them a huge binder that has all of their communication strategies, all their behavior strategies. It's a very effective program, and we're looking at North Star maybe being able to take a last chunk out of these kids and be able to provide those services in Alaska. So we're pretty optimistic that we're going to get one more turn on this win list.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
If you turn to page 6, I'll go through this pretty quickly. This is the other thing that you're going to hear a lot more about at the top of the page, working with young children to prevent severe disturbances. What we've discovered, and actually this we didn't discover this, I mean, people have known this for a long time, and part of it's pretty intuitive, and that is that, you know, kids that experience a lot of trauma when they're growing up, the more trauma they experience, the poorer their long-term outcome. So if you go in and survey people in corrections or juvenile justice and you start adding up their adverse childhood experiences, well, what a shock. They've got a lot of them. They had addicted parents. They were abused and neglected. They come from a divorced home. They were low income. They moved a lot. And what that's helped us to do is to say, well, look, if we're going to get ahead of the curve, then we've got to start addressing the kids with these high numbers of adverse childhood experiences as early as we possibly can. And there are strategies that can turn those kids around and change that trajectory. Mentoring, for example. You can take a kid who's had a pretty traumatic childhood, and if you get them connected to an adult, who's stable and sober, who cares about them and stays engaged with them and mentors them and encourages them, and, you know, they'll start to do better. So one of the lessons out of Bring the Kids Home is that, look, if we're going to, you know, get ahead of this curve, it's going to have to be by taking a look at these adverse childhood experience data. And by the way, you know, one of the things, if you haven't had a presentation on adverse childhood experiences, you really should. Because what you learn is not only do those adverse childhood experiences lead to alcoholism, suicide, criminal behavior, single parenthood, all of that, but it has physical effects, higher rates of heart disease, higher rates of diabetes, even things that you wouldn't think would be connected to being from a divorced family with an addicted parent. Why would that give you heart disease? It's part of the whole stress reaction of the human body to the whole situation. So that's going to be very important. And that, again, came up, I think, in Senate Finance, when Senator Kelly challenged the trust to start looking at a legacy initiative to try to get ahead of the curve here and try to invest heavily in early prevention, primary prevention work, to try to stop this intergenerational transfer. And that's totally in keeping with what we've learned from Bring the Kids Home, and it's totally in keeping with the Recover Alaska initiative. And we're pretty excited about working with the Finance Committee over the next year or so and see if we can't come up with something. There's two ways looking at leaner budgets down the road. There's two philosophies. One is, you just have to squeeze it down into a smaller box. You know, hard as that's going to be, you just squeeze it into a smaller box. The problem with that is the pressure inside the box just keeps getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And eventually bad things happen in the community or people start to get hurt, and then you got a problem. The other, which we're very encouraged to see the Senate Finance Committee start to look at, is, well, maybe we should invest heavily now in primary prevention and try to reduce the size of the box we need by encouraging better success for our citizens rather than just continually be fighting at the back end of the problem.
Thank you. So I'm moving just a little bit ahead in the next slide, which is the bottom of page 6, has a decrement on the evidence-based family therapy model.
Yes, let me, Senator, get to there.
Okay.
Here's the deal that the trust made with Commissioner Sturer. What we said is, look, we're winding down on this initiative. We got 2 years to go, probably. We will match the state dollar for dollar for what you're willing to invest into the base in FY14. And we agreed on a $1 million split. And that was the recommendation the trustees made. That was the recommendation the commissioner made. Of course, the Office of Management and Budget and the governor are trying to fit that into their overall budget strategy. And so they reduced the general fund part of that by about $330,000. What we will do, if that reduction remains at the end of the day, we will reduce the MTAR by $330,000. And we'll have a match. It's just not going to be a million-to-million-dollar match. Of course, we don't recommend that because, as you can see, what we're looking at funding in the FY14 budget is this getting earlier and earlier into the process by looking at evidence-based family therapy, as well as early intervention for young children. And of course, the trust is willing to continue to front the administrative costs of the initiative, plus the independent evaluation, you know, because, yeah, it's great for us to tell you what we've accomplished, but, you know, we need to have it reviewed independently. And then the contract we have for the education subcommittee. We have a contractor that convenes that group and helps them set the agenda, et cetera. So budgetarily, that's the big decision for the subcommittee as we look at the Bring the Kids Home initiative for 14.
Thank you.
Looking towards 15, you can see the increments, where we're going there and the shift of focus. If there are no questions about Bring the Kids Home, I'll move on to disability justice. I'm going to cover some of these other focus areas pretty quickly, and we have till 3?
I think we have till 3.
Okay.
3:15.
3:15? Okay, I'll try to make sure I fit in the box.
If you're done at 3, we won't kill you.
Understood. Disability justice, of course, 43% of the youth in juvenile justice are trust beneficiaries, as are 42% of incarcerated adults. They also recidivate at a higher rate than non-beneficiaries in the Department of Corrections. turning to page 8, same process as before. First thing we do is pull our partners together. You can see who we work with. And then start looking at strategic strategies that we could use in order to try to reduce the number of people we have in these facilities. You can break that into basically 3 different phases. The first is, well, how can we keep them out of corrections to start with? That's where you get mental health courts, wellness courts, other programs. Housing is critical to keeping people out of the criminal justice system. Then there's, while they're in correctional facilities, whether it be juvenile justice or corrections, what can we do to get them treatment and services while they're in? And of course, there's just been this total turnaround in the policy direction of the Department of Corrections from prior administrations that essentially dismantled virtually all of the treatment programs in corrections. And under the leadership of the governor and Commissioner Schmidt, you know, they've been steadily reintroducing and expanding those treatment programs in corrections. It's been pretty challenging, especially with the Goose Creek 800-pound gorilla pushing their budget around. But and then, of course, at the back end, once they leave corrections, are we providing them with the supports in the community that will enable them to be successful and not end up right back where they were, which is cycling back through the system again? You can see on page 9 some of the outcomes that we've received from this. One thing we did in YK is worked with them to develop a sobering center. They had a huge number of people that were getting picked up and being placed in the correctional center or clogging up the emergency room at the hospital. And so you can see once the sobering center came into operation, we were able to reduce those non-criminal holds by 75%. And then just another example, you can look at the therapeutic courts. We had an independent evaluation done of the Anchorage Mental Health Court and identified savings almost 2.5 times the annual program operating costs. In a minute, we'll talk about the Complex Behavior Collaborative. That's the same type of outcome that we're looking for. How much does the program cost versus how much is it saving or avoiding? And it's got to be right side up. If it goes upside down, you need to stop funding it. So again, looking at the bottom, you can see kind of how the budget looks going forward in disability justice. Turning over to page 10, You can see, again, the last part of the disability justice focus area. And the reason I wanted to go over this with this subcommittee is because health and social, well, let me back up. People ask the Commissioner of Corrections all the time, well, how are you going to reduce this recidivism? Right. You know, how are you going to keep people from coming back in your prison? And the Commissioner does his best to answer that question. That's not really his prime function. And he isn't likely in his department to be even the major factor in stopping recidivism. What's going to reduce recidivism is when they leave Commissioner Schmidt, what happens to them in the community? Do they have sober housing to go into? Do they have access to employment and job training? Do they have access to treatment? And corrections can do a lot, but it's health and social services, frankly, at the end of the day, along with AHFC, which is going to make the biggest difference in whether you reduce recidivism over time. So I wanted to make sure this subcommittee was aware of that intimate connection and not thinking, oh, this is just a corrections problem.
Yeah. And sitting on as the judiciary chairman, we actually have asked the commissioner that question. And so on the reentry task force, I think you are now well seated there. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the question is a valid question. And evidence-based programs is where they're heading. So
yep.
Everything from PACE program to housing are on their list of things. And one of the things that we'll be dealing with on a at least on one of the issues is how to allow those who are coming out to get driver's licenses so that they can be productive, but still hold them in some degree of accountability so that so they get to produce, but they have to do it under accountable measures. And so you'll see some of those things coming along too.
Well, and Senator Coghill, also looking at the barrier crimes
yep.
issue is important. We disqualify them from so many jobs. Now, some make a total sense. You don't want a sex offender working at a daycare. But when you look at some of the other connections between a crime and a barrier to employment, you know, all we're doing is just making it harder for them to be successful.
And in my office, we've done a little bit of study on that. Over 400 places in statute where we have barrier crimes, and there's no kind of monolithic way of navigating that. So we're going to have to figure out a way to let them filter through a doorway that that has that discussion on the value of balancing out a felon, for example, mm-hmm. to say you can't expunge it. So it is going to be a slow process, I think. But I know for my part, I'm willing to keep plugging away looking at it.
Well, adding barrier crimes was good politics and poor policy at the end of the day. So.
Well, but a lot of it was because people were being either mistreated in elderly homes or mistreated as youngsters were vulnerable. So the idea of protecting them was paramount.
Sure.
And then now we have to figure out, okay, did the protection put barriers that other people can't get over?
Right. What's the balance?
Right. So I think protection was the first order of business. And now we have to figure out, okay, from protection, how do we make people available for productive life, knowing that that safety is in place.
Exactly. So I'll move on to housing. Of course, we tell you this every time we come here. It doesn't matter what beneficiary group you're talking about. If they don't have access to safe, affordable housing with necessary supports, they are not going to be successful in the community. And I was just at a meeting the other day where, once again, it was touted how much money, over $1 billion, AHFC has paid into the general fund in dividends. And that's a wonderful thing, but it didn't go to housing. If you had taken those dividends that AHFC paid and had invested them in housing instead of dumping it into the permanent fund, in my opinion, we would not be where we are today, where getting affordable housing for individuals is an incredible challenge in all parts of the state. And you can look at the bottom of this page, on the graph on the right, you can look at, if you're on SSI and state supplement, you're making about $12,000 a year. If you have a minimum wage job, which for many of our beneficiaries is a good thing to get that far, they aren't likely to get way past that, you're at $16,000. And then the cost of living, including a studio apartment, is $28,000. How do you make that work? Even if you can do the math doesn't work. So again, that's why you see projects like the Longhouse and Carlick Manor, is we are desperate to get our beneficiaries housed, because they will be far more successful if we can do that. But the challenges are substantial.
To be fair, there are several elements that go into this. First of all, I'd have to check the numbers on if all the money from AHFE went into the permanent fund.
It went in the general fund.
Right. You said permanent fund.
Oh, I misspoke. I'm sorry.
And from the general fund goes somewhere near $1.5 billion into health and social service issues. So, you know, I might argue on where that all lands effectively, but to be fair, your point is well taken. The income level, I would have to look at in detail to figure out, you know, what these numbers mean, because, and I don't know, I'd have to probably almost lay out in a graph who can get, you know, food stamps, which gives you more disposable cash, who gets energy assistance, who will give you more disposable cash, who would get housing assistance, which would give you more disposable cash, who would get temporary assistance for needy families, which is also give you more disposable cash. So a lot of it depends on some people actually will get more assistance than I earn under some of those circumstances. I know that's not generally true, but I have seen it happen. So when we're counting income, in many ways, I'm trying to figure out, okay, from the assistance level, what is their actual cash value that they go forward in any one given month, let alone just the disposable cash. So I know a homeless person doesn't fall into a lot of that, but when we're talking about our general welfare programming, some people do very, very well, and some people do very, very poorly. And a lot of it is based on how we qualify, you know. And it would be good for those of us, especially on this committee, to try to see that what that looks like graphically, horizontally, because there are some people who may very well do very, very well under some of our programs. Others have no access to them, you know. And so it'd be interesting to see, from our perspective, how that looks. And probably now that you've said it to me in this graphic form, probably will set a question that I'll talk to our own commissioner about. Help me understand that better.
Senator, but I think that sounds like a productive line of inquiry.
Mm-hmm. All right, thank you.
Moving on, I'm going to go quickly through these next slides. On page 11, you see our partners in housing. At the bottom, you see some of the identification of the numbers of homeless people that we have. Turning to page 12, same thing we do, strategic thinking. What are the strategic ideas we have for turning the curve, and the results for the beneficiaries? Housing First, we now have a Housing First project, of course, in Anchorage, the flagship. And now there's a Housing First project run by Tanana Chiefs Conference in Fairbanks. And Juneau is looking at a Housing First project as well.
So just for what it's worth, and I have a staff member who's been very involved in that, and so I watch it with a little bit of a critical eye, mm-hmm. but have generally been supportive. That's another one of those projects that I think has to stay very true to a modeling integrity. And is that something that you're watching on feedback information?
Absolutely, Senator, because in Anchorage, for example, that project has been successful, and the mayor is supporting a relocation and expansion of Carlick Manor. And so we need to ensure that that program keeps delivering the goods, mm-hmm. Or there's not going to be much interest in an expansion. There are plenty of people that need that service. So I'm going to go ahead and turn over to page 14, Workforce Development. I'm going to go through this very quickly. Again, no matter how much funding is in the department's budget, if the programs don't have, if they don't have a qualified workforce they can recruit and retain, then we're not going anywhere. Moving ahead to page 16, at the bottom, the Beneficiary Projects Initiative. This is almost totally funded. In fact, it is virtually totally funded by the trust. And I know, Senator Coghill, you'll understand the premise here. You know, in the substance abuse field, the concept of peer-to-peer support has always been bedrock of substance abuse treatment. AA is totally a peer-to-peer support. In the mental health field, it grew from a medical model, and it has relied more heavily on, well, you need somebody with a bunch of letters after their name, making a lot of money, to treat you. And having lay people involved, they just don't have those skills and abilities. Well, what we've learned is, no, actually, people with mental health issues can be very valuable in supporting each other. They've been there, done that. They can relate to the frustrations that come with having a mental illness. And so through the Beneficiary Projects Initiative, we've actually created employment opportunities by creating a certified peer support specialist career path so that people can actually be employed to provide peer-to-peer support. And the department's been very supportive of enabling that to be billed under Medicaid. And this is a much more cost-effective way of supporting people in recovery than relying constantly on our most expensive, most professional level of care. Not that we don't need that, but that this is a component that needs to be included.
Sure, and I think this model shows a couple of things to me as a legislator. First of all, you learn from those people helping each other. I mean, I think there's just, you learn how behavioral support levels just stabilize many, many things. But on the barrier crime issue, it also shows that those that have been there can actually help those as long as they are on a healthy pathway themselves.
Exactly.
And once that happens, the value just goes skyrocketing. And so that's something we haven't factored into many of our other areas.
Yep.
So, and I see this as probably one of the better models for that.
Okay, thank you. Going to page 18, at the bottom of the page is our joint legislative priorities that we share with our advisory boards. And the one that I want to talk about, which I believe you have some material on, is the Complex Behavior Collaborative. And in a second, I'm going to talk about this document right here. Let me go back and explain what the Complex Behavior Collaborative is. We talked about these kids with multiple diagnoses. What we started to find is that in many cases, hang on, let me let you get settled here.
Somebody shuffled my deck.
No comment. Well, I can talk about the
concept. Sure, keep going. Yeah.
Sure.
So what we had was people in the Pioneer Home, in assisted living, living at home, who had difficult to manage behaviors, were getting thrown out of their placement and ending up in API, and worse than that, we started shipping them out of state. And so we ended up looking at, well, wait a minute, now we got 14 people out of state, now we got 20 people out of state. Does this sound familiar? I mean, you know. So we started saying, hey, wait a minute, we got to look at this or we're going to end up here in 5 years with a Bring the Adults Home initiative.
Bring Grandma home.
Bring Grandma home. And so what we did is the trust contracted with WICHE, the Western Interstate Commission on Higher Education, and we asked them to look at this problem and look at what other states do and how might we you know, solve some of this difficult to manage behaviors. And what they said was, look, here's what you need to do. You got to stop the people from being removed from their home or their placement in the first place. And the only way you can do that is to provide intensive technical assistance to either the family or the provider so that they feel comfortable dealing with these behaviors. And the way it works, if you remember the old Mission Impossible show where Phelps would get an assignment, and then he had a sheaf of photographs, and he would go through and he would say, yeah, this one's good for this mission, nah, not that one. This one's good, not that one. So the way the collaborative works is Rita Sullivan in Health and Social, in the Division of Behavioral Health, has collected a cadre of consultants with a range of expertise. Some are experts in managing Alzheimer's patients, some people with chronic mental illnesses, some with intellectual disabilities like autism. And when a referral comes in, she matches that placement and client to the experts. The experts then go into the actual environment. They assess the individual and the environment and the program, and they work with the provider or family to develop a behavior intervention strategy. And they train them right there in the placement.
Yeah, sure.
And then when they leave, and this is perhaps the most important part, when they leave and the phone call comes in and says, well, you know, that worked great for the first week, but now this is happening. What do we do about this? They're available to provide ongoing consultation. There's two benefits to this. Of course, the first one is we stabilize that placement for that individual. The other is that we will, over time, raise the level of competency of these placements to deal with a wider range of behaviors. Because now, instead of having someone act out, and you, oh, I don't know what to do about that, send them an API and we don't want them back. Now it's like, well, we were able to deal with Jeff, and Senator Coghill's kind of like him. You know, we can try some of this stuff. We don't have to just get rid of him the first time he acts out. And strategies. For example, 20 years ago, one of my cases at Disability Law was a man who had a sudden onset of Alzheimer's in the Pioneer Home. Now, this is before the Pioneer Home had any services for Alzheimer's patients. He was a very robust pioneer, literally pioneer of Alaska, who was severely demented. And a little Filipino nursing assistant came up and was going to take his sweater off without talking to him, and he decked her. And the reaction of the Pioneer Home was, call the police. Mm-hmm. And the police come out and go, What? You know, we can't take this guy to jail. I mean, he doesn't know anything that's going on. Well, this guy ended up in API. They sent him to Harborview. He came back to API. Well, he wasn't unmanageable or violent. They didn't know how to approach him. So that's the role of the complex behavior collaborative. What we had the department do, the division, is start to look at, okay, is this thing cost effective? And so what they did is for individuals that had been in the CBC for 3 months, they looked 3 months back. So 3 months before they went in and the 3 months they were in. If they were in 5 months, because remember, we're still in startup here, then they looked back 5 months. And then they took some of the applications that were not accepted and took a look at their costs. Now, this isn't perfect data yet, but we're getting there. And at least initially, this is starting to look like a pretty reasonable strategy to help solve this problem. So here's where we are funding-wise. For FY13, there's $650,000 in the budget. Half of that was trust money. Half of that was GF. For FY14, we had initially requested $650,000, so the entire annualized cost, to be placed in the base budget to run the CBC. We understand it's a tight budget environment, and we haven't fully proven up this program yet. So what we're recommending to the subcommittee is a $450,000 one-time increment to allow us to collect another year's worth of data at the current level of effort being put towards the project. And then be able to make our case both through the governor's budget process and then through the legislative process next year when we have better data. Mm-hmm. This is a keystone project because we don't have a backup plan. If you decide you don't want to keep going with this, we don't have another way to stem this flow. Now, it doesn't mean we won't go back to the drawing board and work on it, but this is our best suggestion, and at least preliminarily, it looks like it's delivering. And with that, I think I'm pretty close.
You're pretty good. You're doing pretty good. Pretty good. Well, it sounds like an avenue for doing, assignment of priority. I think that's something we got to do. I mean, it's just how do you get the right people with the right help, right?
Yep.
I mean, so it's not unlike what we're trying to do in some of the other areas on case management and the medical home model. Almost every place we're trying to figure out how do we get the best information, the best expert at the right place at the right time. So that it sounds like this is the same type of approach. Yes. So, and it looks to me like the client base, the stream won't stop.
No, Senator, I don't.
You're not going to run out of work.
No.
So then it's a matter of can you get the experts, the available help to them under the best conditions you can do it. And so it sounds like the right approach to me. I don't know what, like you say, what's the alternative is to make sure that everybody who sees them the first time becomes a case manager, right?
Something like that.
Yeah.
The problem is that if you don't have access, to behavioral experts that can help you manage the behavior, when are you going to case manage them too?
Right. Exactly. There has to be a recognition, and that's what happened here first, right?
Yep.
Okay. So it's just not only prioritization, but recognition.
Recognition. Correct. And again, trying to keep them in their initial placement, whether it's the family or an assisted living home or the Pioneer home so that they don't bubble up into the higher levels of care. Or the worst case scenario is we start continuing to ship them to Idaho and we send money to Idaho for them to hire people to take care of them.
The jail population has the same issue. They end up with people in the jail who probably should end up in treatment, the way I understand it.
A few.
So would this be helpful there as well?
Senator Coghill, I think it would in some cases because some of these behaviors, as I said, like with the Pioneer Home example, certain aggressive behavior can be viewed as either a symptom of a disease that needs to be treated and managed or a crime.
Right.
I'm not against criminal law, but it needs to be applied where that type of consequence is appropriate to deal with the behavior. What you're trying to do is punish people and discourage them from continuing that behavior. If you have dementia or schizophrenia or your FAS, that's not working.
Yeah. I mean, your ability to deal with responsibility is going to be one of the big questions. In fact, that's what our whole standards of justice are based on. So. Thank you very much. Any last thoughts? Any questions?
No. Thank you.
All right. You made your point well on that.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
As he always does.
Denise, when's the next meeting? Next meeting is Tuesday, February 19th in Ferrin Camp Room, 8 to 9:30 a.m. We'll be on one of our smaller budgets, the Medicaid budget. We're adjourned.